Today is October 14th, 2018. This is episode 165 of At Percussion. You might notice that there's a female voice today, and that's because our main host, Casey Cangelosi, is on a trip visiting some family today, and Laurel is with him. So Ben and I are flying as a duo today. So I'm Megan Arnge, your host for today. We've got Ben Charles. Hello, Ben.
Hi, everybody.
And we have another guest co-host today, Hannah Hutchins, a grad student here at the University of Missouri. Hi, Hannah.
Hello.
And our guest today is a musician, filmmaker, and cyclist. All his work centers around exploring the boundaries of art and endurance. Whether creating groundbreaking new music, mind-expanding films, pedaling a mountain bike hundreds of miles a day in remote areas, or doing all three at the same time, he is one of the most creative forces of his generation. Please welcome to the show, Peyton McDonald. How's it going?
Hello. Good, thank you.
So, Peyton, I had three people I wanted to ask you about throughout the course of this podcast, and one in particular, I feel like I ask everyone that has an experience with this person about this person. But I remember the first time I saw Peyton perform, I was an undergraduate student at UNT, probably sometime around 2007 or 2008, and Peyton came with his Super Marimba project and performed at UNT. And I still remember the performance. I think I still have the CD in a box somewhere. But I remember you talking about working with Keiko Abe, and there was this one little nugget that just stuck in my head for so long. And you said something to the effect of, it seems like marimba players have this love affair with medium hard yarn mallets. And it's so true. That instrument has such a diverse sound, or any percussion instrument really has such a diverse sound palette. And we seem so in love with this sort of warm cello sort of hum out of the instrument. And I remember you talking about working with Keiko Abe, and she had all sorts of different mallets that she used, like her slap mallets. I know she used on one of her pieces, and I saw on your documentary, you had some sort of slap mallets as well. So could you talk about, one, what it was like to work with Keiko Abe and what you learned from that experience, and two, your sort of interpretation of different sounds out of the instrument?
Sure. Well, working with Keiko was really an amazing experience, and it really changed me as a musician in a lot of ways, because up to that point, I had seen many, many great performers, of course, but being able to stand next to one on stage night after night and in the rehearsal sessions really gave me an idea of what it means to give yourself up completely to the musical situation at hand. And I mean, Keiko would come out on stage, and I did this tour with her. It was a percussion ensemble, the Galaxy Percussion Ensemble, which Mike Udow organized. There were five percussionists, and then Keiko was in the front. And Keiko would come out on stage, and we were playing in some big venues, like 900 seat plus halls that were usually filled. And her ability to project all the way to the back of the hall was just astonishing. And when I say project, I don't just mean loud, but I just mean a kind of intensity and depth of emotion. It was really powerful to experience that. And she's a very humble person. She's a very sweet person. But she's deeply serious about what she does and about her musicianship. And I was just very honored to meet her and work with her. And she has had a big impact on my view of performing. And then your second question is about the mallets, right?
Not necessarily the mallets in particular, but just the voice of the instrument, which I guess would involve mallets. But yeah. But I totally agree about the way that she can just project. It's just amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. In terms of the voice of the instrument, I mean, I think partly what happened has a little bit to do with Lee Howard Stevens, who is a friend of mine, and I'm a Malitech sponsor, you know, and Lee has also been a huge influence on my life as a percussionist and a marimba player. Lee's influence on the industry was and is very, very profound and really changing. And when Lee came on the scene, his ideas about marimba playing and about marimba sound and about marimba construction really revolutionized the instrument. And he had just a huge impact on several generations of percussionists. He's so good and he's so convincing that I think in a way, you know, everyone kind of went in his direction. And as you know, Lee has a particular way of playing the instrument and a particular sound that he likes to get from the instrument, which is a sound that I also strive to get in certain repertoire as well. But there are other things I felt that the marimba was capable of. And what I felt after a while is that things became a little bit circular. So, you know, marimba players were playing a certain way, largely, I think, because of his influence. And then composers were writing a certain way based on that sound. And then manufacturers were making mallets to service that sound and that particular approach to the instrument. So everyone became kind of in a feedback loop of sorts, which is not a bad thing because it's a beautiful way to play the instrument. But I don't think it's the only way to play the instrument. And I think in a way, as much as I love marimba and even vibraphone, in some ways they're timbrally rather bland instruments compared to, say, a cello or a violin. You know, string players have all this timbral nuance right at their fingertips, all these things they can do to bring out all different kinds of color. And we can do a little bit of that with the same pair of mallets by playing on the nodes or tipping up on the mallets, but it's not that dramatic. If you really want to get a full spectrum, you need to look at different kinds of mallet options. And it very much depends on the repertoire you're playing. You know, using slap mallets, I don't think would be appropriate for a Bach cello suite or Reflections on the Nature of Water. Sometimes I use all kinds of things. When I do free improv concerts, I usually have about 100 different mallets set on music stands in front of the instrument. And then I have a little table on the low end of the instrument where I just have all this stuff. I have sheets of plastic and newspapers and I don't know, whatever I can usually scrounge up around the venue. And when I'm improvising, I'm constantly putting those things on top of the marimba or under the bars. And I often take the upper manual and I drop it onto the lower manual. So when you play the upper manual, it kind of chatters on the lower manual, none of which damages the instrument at all or scratches it or anything else. But it opens up a whole new world of marimba playing. So that's kind of the tack I took. I mean, I kind of, to some extent, some of the artistic choices I've made were out of necessity in the sense that I look around me and I see all these incredible marimba players. I mean, really first-rate artists playing and getting a particular sound out of the instrument. And I thought, you know what? I'm not sure I really have anything to add to that. There are already people who are much better than I am who are doing that. Where else could I fit in? What else could I contribute to the percussive arts community and to the instrument? And I felt that timbrally, the instrument really needed broadening. This was about, you know, 15 years ago or so that I came to this conclusion. So since then, I've been working on that, both with my own composing, with my own improvising, and even with pieces I commissioned from other composers.
That's awesome. Yeah. So I have a question that's not related to the marimba at all, because the marimba would be very hard to transport on a mountain bike when you're
yes,
traveling 2,500 miles. So I became aware of this project that Peyton was doing, I think all the way back when you first did, I think a Kickstarter or some kind of crowdfunding campaign or something on social media a couple of years ago. And I was like, whoa, that sounds crazy. I cannot wait to see how this project will turn out. And it turned out fabulously. And I watched the film this summer, but Peyton produced this film called The Sonic Divide in 2017, where he rode the bike trail that follows the Continental Divide. And this bike trail, correct me if I'm wrong, Peyton, but crosses the Continental Divide 30 different times. So he commissioned 30 composers to write music for him to perform and premiere at these specific points on his trip. So the documentary just follows him on this trip, and it's incredible. It's emotional, and it's amazing. And so I'm just curious, if it looks like there have been several film festivals that this film has been featured in, and I'd like to hear you just talk a little bit about the film, but also of, you know, where it is now. Is it still at film festivals? What's your hope for the project in the future? Or is that kind of the end of it?
Yeah. You know, I never intended to make a film, and I never intended to become a filmmaker. My original plan was to perform the pieces at each of the divide crossings or near them, and video them and then just put them up on YouTube. And that was it. That was my original plan.
Okay.
But then as the project was developing and the pieces were coming in and I started practicing them, they were so beautiful and so creative and so thoughtful. I thought, you know, it might be interesting to do some interviews with a few of the composers and then just add a little bit of that footage at the end or beginning or whatever of the performance, just as added content. I started doing interviews, and then the interviews were incredible. They were, again, so thoughtful and interesting. And that's when I realized maybe actually there's a film here. So I learned filmmaking. And what I did, I kind of figured all that out by about December of 2015. And I did the actual ride and all the performances in June of 2016. So for the first 5 months while I was preparing for the thing, I also learned how to use Premiere, which is the one of the major editing software platforms for filmmaking. I took some lessons and I watched a ton of tutorials, and I made about 7 or 8 shorts leading up to the actual event. Most of which I've taken down because they weren't very good, but they were a way for me to practice filmmaking.
Sure.
And then I did the event. And then by the time I was leaving for the event, I knew that it was going to become a film. So I came back from it when I finished it and I edited the film. And then by, I think it was January 2017, it was basically done. And I started submitting it to film festivals. And I was lucky that I ended up landing in 6 of them. You know, I thought the music business was hard, but oh my God, the film world is brutal. I mean,
wow.
I didn't get in any of the really big ones like Cannes. I didn't even apply to those. I knew there was no way. But even so-called smaller festivals are still getting around 2,500 or 3,000 submissions for like 20 or 30 slots. So it's really tough because they often give you the metrics. When you get a rejection letter, they'll often tell you how hard it was. So I applied to, I think I applied to around 40 festivals. There's there's software, or not software, but there are website platforms for doing this where you load up your film and then you can do searches to try to find festivals that are good fits for what you're doing.
Okay.
So I applied to about 40 of them and I got in 6, which I felt I was delighted. And it did pretty well. And one of them, it won best documentary. And then I also made a short version of the film, which is 10 minutes. And so let's see.
Is that the trailer or no?
No, the trailer is just like a 90-second, like a trailer. If you go to the Sonic Divide website, uh-huh, on the page, it says the film. There are actually 3 versions of the film. There's the full 90-minute version, which got into 3 film festivals. Then there's an hour-long version where I actually cut out some of the music and it's more focused on the cycling. And I did that for some cycling events that I went to last year and presented that. And then there's the 10-minute short. So the film festivals, 3 of them accepted the full length and 3 of them accepted the short. So the short won runner-up in one of them, and then the full length one won best documentary at one of them, which was great. So at any rate, it's done with that. It ran through the film festivals last year, and then I did a whole bunch of performances where I traveled around the country. And I would often go to universities and be there for a couple of days, and I would play a recital and we'd do a screening of the film. I did a TEDx talk. I don't know, a bunch of stuff like that. I went to some cycling festivals, and now basically it's kind of done. I mean, I did a couple of festivals this summer where I played some Sonic Divide repertoire, and then I'm doing a few little recitals next year, but I'm honestly moving on to the next project at this point.
Very cool.
Well, I had a question. Actually, it was funny. Well, one of the things I was thinking as I was watching was like, what the hell did he eat? And then like 20 or 30 minutes in, like right when that question popped into my head, there was this whole segment on like, you had to eat 7,000 calories a day to be able to do this.
Yeah. And that's crazy. I have an interjection about this, which is hilarious. This is exactly what I was going to say next, Ben. We're on the same wavelength. I ran into one of the students at William Patterson, where Peyton teaches, this summer at Interlochen. And I don't know how we started talking about you, Peyton, but she was like, oh my gosh, yes, Peyton McDonald and blah, 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 the film and blah, blah, blah. And she started talking about the food section. And she said that you added that later because everyone kept asking, what in the world do you eat along the way? So she said, so I went back and rewatched that part and I was like, oh yeah, that's so funny. I could see how that was just like an interjection. It was a planned into the film originally.
Yeah, I mean, originally I had an assistant editor who kind of helped me with some technical issues mainly, but also aesthetically. There were a few times I bounced ideas off of him. And he thought, originally I had it in the film, and he thought we should trim the film down. So that was one of the things we cut. But then after the first screening, actually the first 2 or 3 screenings, it seemed like 90% of the questions on the Q&A were about food, and people kept asking. So I thought, all right, I'm just going to ignore his advice, and I put it back in there.
Okay.
The music on that part was great too.
I know.
But then my my other like logistical question related to this was, I was sitting there going, so as far as I could tell, and I'm probably wrong in this, but when I was watching, it looks like you had one pair of mallets that you used the whole time. And if you broke one, it's not like you could have just bought another mallet right on the trail somewhere. So did you carry more than just those two mallets, or was it just lucky you made it through with one pair?
No. Yeah, I had a pair of the Malatech Reds. They're kind of like Becker Blues, you know, but I brought three of them. So I had one extra one stashed in my frame bag.
Gotcha. Still, that's not a whole lot of cushion there.
No. I mean, when you're doing this ultra, you know, there's different ways to do bike tours. I actually started off kind of more from a racing perspective, and then I realized I like racing, but not for weeks on end. And so I ended up sort of moving back to a more of a touring pace. But my touring pace is pretty aggressive. I mean, my smallest days, there were a few days I only did like 50 or 60 miles, but most days I was pushing around 100 or 130 miles, which, you know, if you're on a road bike, that's not very impressive. But you have to remember, it's a fully loaded mountain bike, and you're on a lot of times very slow surfaces, because sometimes the roads are very washboardy, or they're very sandy, or they're muddy. And there's often a lot of hike a bike where you're pushing your bike through boulder fields and stuff like that. So some of those miles come really slow and hard, you know. So I like to push bigger miles because for me, there's an aesthetic component to the cycling, kind of like the music. And I like riding basically from dawn to dusk and sometimes into the night. There's a certain flow state I get into emotionally and mentally that I don't feel like I get quite the same way if I'm only, in quotation marks, riding 40 or 50 miles. So if you're doing those kinds of miles, though, you want a light bike, and you start counting ounces everywhere. I mean, I had everything on that bike I used every day. There was nothing that wasn't essential. And that's also aesthetically kind of beautiful, because my life in general is very complicated. Like almost all of us, you know, I have a lot of things on my plate. I'm juggling things. And, you know, I live in a house that has a lot of stuff in it that requires maintenance and care. And it's kind of nice to have everything you need on your bike underneath you. And really, your focus is just getting from point A to point B each day and making some music along the way. It's really great.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Go for it. I have a question. I'm just really curious about what information you gave the composers that you commissioned, and if that varied based on where you were geographically. Like, maybe in this place I'll have a lot of rocks, and finding a log might be difficult or impossible.
Yeah.
And so obviously the compositions are fairly open-ended for the most part, but I would like to know what you told them beforehand.
Great question.
Yeah, that is a great question. Well, you know, I told them that they had to limit it to basically found percussion. So it could be the bike, it could be logs, rocks, leaves, the dirt, my body. I told them I'd be happy to sing or chant or speak, any of that kind of stuff. But in terms of the singing, I gave them a specific range to work in. I mean, when I sing, you know, I have a whole other life as a classical singer of Drupad, a form of classical music from North India. And when I sing that music, usually in a concert setting, you know, my voice has about a 2.5-octave range. But when I'm pedaling a bike 100 miles a day in the heat in the desert, you know, I compress that to about an octave because I just knew that, like, my lower register would not be happening and my upper register would probably not be so great. And so things like that. But yeah, it's hard to know, you know, exactly what you're going to find out there and how resonant it's going to be. So the composers were all very good about that. I mean, a few of them chose specific divide crossings, like Jerome Kitsky. He really wanted his piece done at Togati Pass, for example. But there were, I don't know, 4 or 5 composers who did that. But other ones said I could do their piece anywhere, you know, as long as it was near a divide crossing, or even some of them just said anywhere on the trail they were fine with. But they had sometimes kind of specific things they wanted me to do. But the one thing I did tell them is that I could not carry any gear other than the mallets. Because I know, you know, my experience having commissioned hundreds of composers over the years is that that's a very slippery slope. If you tell one of them, oh, yeah, sure, I'll carry this little triangle, then pretty soon you're basically taking, you know, a full percussion studio on your back. I was pretty firm about that.
Yeah, good point. So we've got some questions on Facebook. And actually, Casey left a question. He said, Casey here. Hi, Peyton. So sorry I missed you on this episode. I'd love to know how performing outdoors without a traditional audience has changed your mindset for traditional concert hall performances.
Huh. That's a very good question.
If it has.
Yeah. I don't know if it has. Well, I think the only kind of concrete answer I could give you is that it was very freeing. Mm-hmm. Because as I talk about in the film a little bit, there's a lot of chatter that surrounds what we do, in the sense that, at least there's a lot of chatter in my head. Let me put it that way. I shouldn't assume anything for anyone else. But in my head, there's often a lot of chatter when I'm performing in concert halls, because the situations are fairly specific and contextual, and there's a lot of cultural norms and baggage that come with any performance, right? So a lot of that falls away when you're in the middle of nowhere and there are no people there. Now, it's not exactly that there are no people, because I was filming it and I figured I would use these in the film, but still it's really different when in that situation. So I don't know if it really changed what I do in the concert hall so much, other than it just confirmed for me how important it is for me to spend a lot of time in natural settings, and especially in an active way. I like to move through natural settings. I mean, I like to stop and meditate often, but I like hiking. I like trail running. I like mountain biking. I like swimming in lakes and rivers. And I like making music in those places. And I tell you what it does. You know, there's certain like careerist chatter that goes on in my head sometimes, you know, like, oh, I wonder if the critics are going to show up to this concert, or, oh, Megan's sitting in the front row, I wonder if she noticed that my left-handed, one-handed roll is kind of crappy today, or, you know, things like that. It's just, it's just stuff that goes on your head, and it's natural because it's a social business, and what people think of you matters. It leads to gigs, it leads to careers, right? So it's very hard not to have those thoughts. But when you're in a place like the Gila Wilderness or the Great Divide Basin, you know, those places have been around a long time. Way longer than I'll be around, than any of us will be around, way longer than the Percussive Arts Society has been around, way longer than Carnegie Hall has been around, you know. So all that chatter falls away. It's very it falls away. It's very humbling to be in those places. And it just reminds me that my life is super short. And all of our lives are super short. We're like these little sparks, if you think about it from a cosmic perspective, and then we're gone. And so it helps me relax and just enjoy the moment and just be grateful to be here and be making music.
Yeah, that statement actually reminds me of the way John Luther Adams talks about Inuksuit, you know, is that we come to this environment and we interact with it, but then we leave it without leaving our footprint there, you know? Mm-hmm. And yeah, I love the way that you said, you know, it's the environment is going to be there for much longer than we are and has been there much longer. I'm always curious to find more outdoor music projects. And of course, we've talked about Inuksuit several times on the show, the piece for 9 to 99 percussionists by John Luther Adams. And I did a little bit of research actually for my topic today. Maybe I'll give Peyton a break for just a second and tell you all about another project called Music in the American Wild that I found. And I've known about it for a little while because two of the co-founders of this group I was in school with at Eastman, and they founded it in 2016, and it began as a celebration of the National Park Service Centennial Celebration. So they thought, what if we pair music with the Centennial Celebration? So during 2016, they brought together 11 composers and 8 performers. And the goal was to fill the country's grandest natural venues with a new opus of inherently American music. So they commissioned all American composers and premiered these all in the national parks. So what they did was toured 7 celebrated national parks to premiere the works in the amazing places that inspired them, supported in part by a grant by the National Endowment for the Arts. They were in caves, they're on mountaintops, in forests, and on lake shores. They honored this major American milestone by letting new music ring out from sea to shining sea. decided to continue this project after 2016 because it was so successful. And they focus on context-driven music that encourages our audiences to explore their environments through a different lens, engage with contemporary music in a new way, and foster the sense of community between performers, listeners, and the spaces that surround them. So who is part of this project? The two co-founders I mentioned were Emlyn Johnson. She plays flute, and she's the director, and Daniel Ketter, who's co-director and cello. And we're actually very lucky because they live in Missouri now.
Oh, really?
Yes, Daniel is a cello professor at Missouri State, and Emlyn is lecturer in music as well. So it's cool to have them so close by, and I hope they bring some projects to the Midwest. The rest of the ensemble is sort of a collective, so it's changed a little bit. But just in looking at their website, the percussionist has been pretty consistent, and that's Colleen Bernstein from she's at University of Michigan right now. So the Music in the American Wild also recently just released an album, and it's audio, but it's also a video album. And the video album combines an hour of footage from their 2016 tour through the national parks, and it's documented by Jorge Arzak. And let's see what else here. Oh, it is available to stream on iTunes, Apple Music, Amazon, or through their label Artist Share. So I encourage you all to check that out. It's Music in the American Wild. And I'm curious if any of you have heard of other projects or other artists or performers who perform outdoors and similar projects.
I can think of two others.
Yeah.
A couple. Well, one is there were a couple of people involved with Sonic Divide. Eve Biglarian is a composer in New York City.
Okay.
And Eve is an amazing human being, and she has an amazing creative voice. And she did a project 3 or 4 years ago where she floated down the whole Mississippi River, and she collected sounds as she went and made pieces from those sounds. And it's a whole project. If you go to just Google Eve Biglarian and go check out her website, you'll see
cool.
it. The other composer involved with Sonic Divide was Taylor Hobynum, who worked a lot with Anthony Braxton and various other people. But Taylor also did a bike trip out in California maybe 4 years ago. It's a little different than mine in the sense that he wasn't commissioning pieces, but he was improvising with people that he met along the way, and then sometimes taking samples and emailing them out to friends who would use those MP3s as raw material for their own creative compositions. But okay. If you check out Taylor's site, he did some really interesting work there. Oh, and the other involved with Sonic Divide was Nat Evans, who is a composer. I think he's in Oregon right now, Oregon or Washington. Nat hiked maybe 4 years ago. He hiked the entire Pacific Crest Trail, and he also collected sounds while he was out there and then used those to create compositions. That I think the way he did it was they were kind of open source, so that he would create things and then he would share them with other composers who would create things from that. So at least those three. And then the other last one I'll mention is just last week I produced a piece by Robert Morris, the composer based at Eastman, mm-hmm. called Oracle, which is an outdoor piece. And we did it here at William Patterson in the High Mountain Nature Preserve. And I had about 40 musicians strung out in the woods, including chimes and 4 vibraphones, which we hauled into the woods. That was quite a feast. But we had trumpet. It's an open score, so you can use any combination of instruments. Yeah. But you should definitely check out Bob Morris's Oracle. That would be if anyone listening to this is interested in doing that kind of stuff, that piece is great.
Cool. Yeah, he was at Hannah just reminded me he was at Mizzou this summer. I wasn't here, but he was here for the Mizzou Composers Festival. Yeah.
Oh, great.
Cool. That's awesome. So I'm going to go back to another Facebook question here, because I think it kind of ties to, we've been talking about music and a little bit of your background as a percussionist, and we've talked about outdoors and cycling a little bit. And Alan Lang asks, what was the moment that you decided your passions for these activities needed to come together? And also, what did you do to train and prep, which might be a little bit moving backwards in our conversation, but if you could maybe touch on those a little bit.
Yeah, well, for a while, they were more discreet. I would go on bike trips And then I had my life, you know, as a performing musician and teaching at the university and so on. But what I noticed is that sometimes the mental state that I was in was quite similar, in the sense that, you know, a lot of the music I play is not commercially viable at all. That's an understatement. And it takes a certain, you know, it takes a certain courage to do this stuff, because it's hard to get audiences. It's hard to get people excited, because it's so different than what most people are used to. Even when I first encountered this music as an undergrad, I didn't care for it, honestly. It took me a while to kind of warm up to it. But it's also a phenomenally, you know, it's an incredible experience when you're, when you really find yourself in a new sonic environment that you've never been in before. Science fiction writers often talk about this idea of the sense of wonder. That's kind of the holy grail of science fiction writing, is when you create a world or a situation that put, that really shifts the reader's consciousness, so that all of a sudden they have this, it's a feeling more than anything. It's not an intellectual experience. It's an emotional feeling of, wow, I didn't know this existed. And that feeling can become very addictive in a way. And that's a lot of the music I'm involved with is like that. But so is ultra endurance cycling. Yeah. You know, you find yourself in places mentally and physically that you didn't know were possible, and they're not possible unless you put in a 10-hour day and unless you're by yourself in a remote situation where you're really self-reliant. Mm-hmm. So those things kind of happen. And then I started, as I explained in the film, I actually live a little closer to work now, but for a while I lived 15 miles, and it's a fairly burly commute with a lot of big hills and so on, that I was doing by bike. And so I would pedal for an hour. And then I, at William Patterson, you know, we're kind of a bastion of new music and a lot of experimental stuff. So I'd show up at work, and then I'd be running rehearsals of, you know, John Cage and Xenakis and my own music and my colleagues' music and the students' music. I mean, we just constantly produce new music there. And then I'd get back on my bike and pedal home, sometimes at 1 a.m. because of the way the rehearsals, you know, ended at 12:30 or whatever. And after a while, it just all became one kind of big thing, you know, it kind of flowed together. And that's really how I trained for it, but was through the commute. And then training, that's a long discussion. I don't know if you really want to go into all that, but, you know, there's sort of stages to it, right? When you're doing a big event, you know, strength training early on, and then you get into more speed training, and then the endurance training, which becomes more specific. But as I mentioned in the film, you know, I try to actually mix things up a lot. A lot of swimming, yoga, weightlifting, that kind of stuff. And then in terms of my playing, for that kind of music, it's mainly just a matter of memorizing all the pieces, which was a lot of work because, you know, like Stuart Smith's piece is intricate, as you would probably guess. But also just kind of keeping my chops in shape so that I can respond to things creatively when I'm improvising.
Yeah, very cool. You have a question?
I had a follow-up question about training. So I bike as well. I'm more of a road bike person. But I had the wonderful experience this past summer of falling off a bike going about 30 miles an hour and landing on concrete. And luckily, I didn't somehow break anything. I just kind of scraped up my arm pretty bad. Looks kind of gross. But I was wondering if you had any injuries like that. And for me, it made me appreciate what I do so much more, because I really couldn't do anything music wise for about a week and a half.
Yeah. Well, yes, I've fallen and banged myself up a few times. Usually it's just cuts or bruises. I did break my left wrist in 2015, actually.
Wow.
And that was because I was doing some very technical mountain bike riding out near Seattle with an old buddy of mine. And I should not have been doing it, because I was on an unfamiliar bike. It was my first time using a dropper post. I was using platform pedals where I usually use clipless pedals, and et cetera, et cetera. It was just, I wasn't being smart.
Yeah, that's how mine was too. So, I was like, ooh, I shouldn't have done that.
Yeah. So I had to get surgery, and I have a little titanium pin in one of my bones in my wrist. But amazingly, you know, I came out of that surgery, and a month later, I was back to practicing Pratt and De La Cluse and wailing away, and I was fine, you know, but it did humble me a bit. So now when I still ride technical single track, but now I gear up. I have all these, I spent a good amount of money on these really nice elbow pads and wrist guards, and I have a full face helmet. you know, knee guards, everything else. So I'm more careful with the really technical stuff. But, you know, there's risk in everything. I have friends who have gotten hurt driving their car to work, you know, so.
Sure.
For me, the cycling is an acceptable risk. And the only time I ride my road bike is on Sunday mornings. Other than that, I'm pretty much on the mountain bike because I don't have to ride on the street with the cars.
Yeah.
Yeah, I stay away from them. I'm pretty much on sidewalks or lawns or pretty much anywhere but the street if possible.
Wow, this is awesome. I think we're all bike commuters here.
Yeah.
Yay, bike commuters.
Yay!
My commute is not 15 miles. No. It is one.
Same.
That's good, though.
If you want to talk about some extreme biking, like on the same level as Peyton's talking about here, the only other percussionist I can think of is Morris Poulter, who does like crazy, crazy like Alaska snow racing. And I remember him saying something about when he got hired at University of Arizona, he actually like negotiated in his contract that he could go bike the Iditarod.
Yeah.
Good for him.
That's hilarious. Wow. Okay, I've got one more Facebook question that relates to Sonic Divide, and I have one more on a different topic. So before we get there, this one is from Casey again. And he says, I'm interested in how your general perspective on music has changed. Has the Sonic Divide changed what you look for now when seeking new repertoire? Has it given you new insights into pieces you've past performed?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think what it has done is it has given me more confidence to keep going with experimental music. But I have also realized that it's very important how we share it with the general public. And the way in which we share it matters a great deal. For example, I had, after Bob Morris's outdoor piece last week, I had a teenage girl come up to me and she said something that was so great, I put it on my website. I loved it. I mean, honestly, it was one of the greatest compliments I've ever gotten after a concert. She came up and she said that was the first classical concert I've ever been to that was actually cool. And she was super stoked on this concert. I mean, she absolutely loved it. And it's because, and when I talked to her a little bit about it, she said, I just felt like I could be myself and no one was judging me and I could just enjoy it in my own way.
Yeah.
And I understand what she's saying, you know, because I went to a film presentation a couple years ago at a university. And it was all these, like, it was a film majors and they had brought in some guest filmmaker from California. I don't remember the guy's name, but it was really avant-garde film stuff. And they were having all these very nuanced and technical discussions about the film and they had opened it to the public. But man, I really didn't feel very welcome there. First of all, I didn't know what they were talking about half the time. And secondly, I don't know, there was a lot of arrogance and a lot of, you know, it was just like, it was very kind of exclusive feeling. And it really got me thinking about what we do or what I do a lot of times. I shouldn't say we, but what I do a lot of times in terms of the kinds of concerts I play and the way that I interact with the public. And I have had a number of, like a lot of times my students, you know, most of my students that I work with generally don't come to college with a lot of experience with classical music and certainly not with the more experimental stuff. And what they tell me sometimes is they say, you know, when I first started going to these concerts, I just felt kind of stupid. I felt like I didn't understand what was going on and it made me feel kind of stupid and I just didn't feel like I belonged. And I began to really take that very, very seriously and began to realize that that's my fault. If people are feeling that way, that's my fault. I'm not doing a good job of communicating this to them and I need to fix that because, you know, if it bothers me that no one from the general public is coming, then I need to make it a place where they want to come and where they feel like they're having a good time and they're engaged with it. So the Sonic Divide was important to me because a lot of people after the screening, I can't tell you how many times people said to me things along the lines of, you know, I'm not sure that music was very foreign to me or I've never heard anything like that, but I really liked the way it was presented and it was just really cool and creative and I really got into it by the end of the film. And that really meant a lot to me.
Yeah.
So yeah, that project has really made me think more deeply about how we share this stuff with people.
Right.
And I think we all have a responsibility to think carefully about that.
Yeah. Well, I'm so inspired that, you know, you took it on yourself to learn this video software and, you know, to learn how a whole nother discipline, a whole nother field works, you know. And I think a lot of times the answer is collaboration and finding people who do that already, but I think it's so cool that you're like, well, I'm going to do this myself. I'm going to learn it and do it myself. You know, that's really awesome.
Well, you know, I really didn't intend to get into filmmaking, but what I found is that I kind of have a knack for it, because at least the kinds of films I'm making now, you know, I just finished my second film, by the way, which is a documentary about the New Jersey Percussion Ensemble.
I saw that on your website. I was curious about that.
Yeah, I mean, I literally just finished it this morning. I just imported the mixed audio, and so I'm getting ready to load it up to Vimeo pretty soon and then start submitting it to film festivals, et cetera.
Cool.
But what I found with filmmaking is that for these kinds of films is that it's a lot, the editing stage is a lot like composing music, you know, which is a big part of my life as a composer. And it's a lot like running a festival, which I've done a lot of. And as percussionists, you know, we're all pretty good with logistics because that's a big part of our life. You know, putting together a percussion ensemble concert is, as you know, a mass amount of logistics. And that's a lot of what film is like, too.
Mm-hmm.
I had a question actually sort of completely unrelated to all this stuff we're talking about, but it's another one of the people I wanted to ask you about. A few months ago at this point, Casey came back from Pius's Beta Percussion Institute, where he had worked closely with Michael Udow, who is, I think, just someone that for some reason most younger players don't know, but obviously has been a huge, huge force in the past several decades of percussion music. And I know he was your teacher at University of Michigan, and he was one of the composers that wrote for you, and I'm sure you've worked with him in many other contexts since then. So could you tell us a bit more about Michael Udow?
Yeah, Michael Udow, I think, is one of the great musicians of our time, not just a percussionist, but a composer and a musical thinker. I think the percussive arts community is very lucky to have him. He was an amazing teacher for me, and is still, now I call him Mike, but I, you know, he's still Dr. Udow to me in a lot of ways. And I just have so much respect and admiration for him. You know, what was so great about Mike is that he showed me that we don't have to limit ourselves. I mean, I would go in for a lesson with him and we'd spend an hour working on the nuances of the excerpt from, you know, the snare excerpt from Scheherazade. And then the next week we would be putting together a concert of Fluxus music. And then the next week he'd be, you know, showing me this new orchestra piece he was composing. I mean, I was just very impressed with the breadth of his knowledge and the kind of range of his creativity and his ability to manage a lot of different things creatively. I think he was a 21st century musician before that term existed. And I think the world of him. I just, you know, I feel very blessed. All of my teachers, my gurus have just been amazing. I'm very lucky to have them in my life.
Very cool. I would love to hear more about your experience with classical Indian music. And Oliver Zhu has a Facebook question for us. So maybe I'll go ahead and get to that to make sure that we hit all the Facebook questions today. And maybe that can serve as sort of a segue into talking about that. So Oliver asks, can you talk about your concerto for mridangam and percussion quartet? How did you go about writing the solo part, and how much did you collaborate with Dr. Rohan Christian Murphy during the compositional process?
If I could just interject here real quick and add a little bit to the question, I'm so impressed by the Indian music stuff that you do, because I studied some Indian music with Sriji at UNT. And he talks about, like, Indian musicians don't major in music. They actually major in something else. Like, Sriji majored in accounting to become a musician, because it's so competitive that no matter how good of a musician you are, it's almost like you need a backup field. So the fact that you as an, you know, American were able to make, you know, break ground in that field is just mind-blowing to me.
Thanks. yeah, it is competitive. It's also just different in the sense that Indian classical music is, it's really kind of a soloist and chamber music art form. Whereas Western music has that also, but also the ensemble component is very important to us. Because with Western music, you know, with Western classical music and jazz to some extent, I think the gift that Europe gave the world of music really is an interrelated sort of three-pronged thing, which is polyphony, large ensembles, and a notation system that facilitates that. As far as I know, no other culture has produced those three things at the level of depth and sophistication that we have in Western classical music. And What that means is if you want to study that music, you need to be in an environment where those things can happen, which means you need to be in schools where there are people, where you can have orchestras, where you can have percussion ensembles, choirs, wind ensembles, big bands. I mean, that's really critical if you're going to engage with that music. And that's why going to a university and going to a good music program is very important to us. You know, when I was in India on my Fulbright a few years ago, the Indian students, I did some teaching. I was mostly studying, but I also did some teaching, and I basically taught Western classical music to the Indian students, which was a fascinating experience. But one of the questions they asked me is they said, well, why does it matter where you go to school, or why do you have to get a college degree in music if you're really serious about it? Because in India, they don't. And I explained exactly that to him. You know, it's the ensembles, the polyphony tradition, et cetera. Whereas with Indian classical music, the most important thing is the guru. Mm-hmm. Having a degree in music in India may or may not mean much at all. And the music curriculum there, frankly, is not that great most of the time. It's a little bit haphazard, and the classes are often taught with big groups of people. So the real nuances of pitch and tuning and all that is completely lost. Yeah, I mean, there are some great Indian classical musicians who have degrees in music, but majority of them don't. Or if they do, whenever I've asked them about it, they just kind of brush it aside. You know, they don't consider it an important part of their training. It's all about the guru. Everything is about the guru there. In terms of Rohan's piece, so that's actually a later edition. I've been working with Sean Matavetsky Sean was just here at my house like 10 minutes before we started this interview. We just did 4 Drupad concerts in the last 3 days together. But I've been composing music for Sean since 1999, almost 20 years. And Sean and I developed a notation system for tabla back in 2002 or 2003, which a lot of composers are using now. So I already had this background of working with Indian percussionists. And then when Rohan and I became friends more recently and started working together, we kind of used some of the notational ideas that Sean and I had developed. But yes, we collaborated. And the way we did it is that I asked Rohan a question I generally ask any ensemble or soloist I'm working with, which is, what do you want out of the piece? You know, what kinds of things do you want to do? What interests you? And so Rohan gave me some ideas, and he actually gave me some specific compositions that I worked from as kind of source material.
That's awesome. I don't know how you first started being interested in Indian music in general. Where did that come from?
That came from the Idaho Falls Public Library. I grew up in Idaho Falls, Idaho, which is an amazing place for the outdoors. There was actually a pretty good classical music scene there, Western classical music, because we had a large Mormon population, and the Mormons are very serious about Western classical music. You know, they start their kids generally quite young, and they can play really well. So we had a youth symphony, and we had a kind of part-time professional symphony and an opera company in town. So that was all great. But there wasn't much cultural diversity, and there wasn't much in the way of world music. So my portal to the rest of the world was the public library. And when I was 11 years old, at that point, I was really into jazz drumming and rock drumming. But I went into the public library one day, and this is a true story. I found all these LPs of Ravi Shankar, Ali Akbar Khan, Vilayat Khan, and I didn't know what any of it was. I read the descriptions on the back, and I looked at the pictures, and I thought, man, this looks really interesting. And that same day, I discovered Glenn Gould playing Bach and Horowitz playing Liszt, and I discovered, you know, Bruno Walter conducting Brahms and all this stuff. And so I walked out of the library with a stack of Western classical LPs under one arm and a stack of Indian classical LPs under the other arm. You know, and here I am in my early 40s, and that's basically what I do every day. So
yeah.
Thank you, Public Library.
That's super cool. I love it. They should like put you on a poster and just have you see what your early reading can do.
Yeah, exactly.
That's really cool. Something you said before about, you know, teaching in India on the Fulbright. I had a similar experience to that in Jordan when I was teaching Western classical music, you know, to musicians who were playing primarily classical Arabic music. And it was so interesting, the questions that they asked and that, you know, with the different tuning systems, and it really changed the way I thought about, I guess, the way that we learn music, you know. And it was also so interesting to me that they were able to, like the string players, for example, were able to play Western classical music on their violin, like they're in the orchestra, and then they would tune two of their string two of their strings down, playing a completely different tuning system in classical Arabic orchestra. This is like so interesting to me, being able to exist like sort of in these two different musical traditions at once. That was just a separate thing, but I'm curious about any future projects that you have coming up. We're kind of nearing the end of the hour here, so I just was curious if there's anything that you kind of wanted to plug or want to tell us more about the New Jersey percussion ensemble documentary you have coming out, or any other projects you have coming up in the near future.
Yeah, it's sort of like airplanes at the Newark airport. I got all this stuff ready to launch over the next few years. Well, a couple of things. So New Jersey Percussion Ensemble celebrating our 50-year anniversary, which is really exciting. And I'm now co-directing the ensemble with Peter Jarvis. So that's been a really interesting development in my career, and not something I expected, but I'm really enjoying it. The players are just phenomenal people and great, great players. So we have two recordings that are coming out. One of them has already been released. The other one's coming out soon, which are a series of pieces that Pete and I composed, and then several pieces that other people compose for us. Two recordings coming out. The documentary film is coming out during this fall and kind of winter season. And then we're playing a PASIC showcase concert on Saturday, November 17th. I think it's at 2:00. So if any of the percussionists listening to this are at PASIC, we'd love to meet you and hope you'll join us. It's a concert of concertos that feature Glenn Velez. So Glenn Velez wrote some of the pieces. I wrote a piece, and Pete Jarvis wrote a piece. And then we had a new piece by John Link, who's a composer out here in New York area, composed specifically for this.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, Glenn is just an amazing player and a beautiful human being. So we're super happy to be collaborating with Glenn. So there's all that happening with New Jersey Percussion Ensemble. My life as a Drupad singer is just kind of ongoing. You know, I think it looks pretty solid that I'll be doing my first tour in India in late February and March as a Drupad singer. So I'm really excited about that, to be singing on some festivals. And then I have a solo marimba CD that is done, and I've got it printed, and it's on it's released through Composer's Concordance, which has distribution through Naxos. So it'll be hitting the online world within a month or so. But that's a series of commissioned pieces by Elliot Sharp. Who else is on that? Robert Morris has a piece. Stuart Smith wrote me a piece. So that's some repertoire I think is just great, and I hope the percussion community will check it out, and you know, people will consider playing some of those pieces. What else am I doing? Well, I'm planning another big follow-up to Sonic Divide in 2020. I think I'm pretty much set on it at this point. This is actually the first time I've sort of discussed it publicly, but I'm looking at doing this route. It's bigger. It's a 5,000-mile route from the Atlantic to the Pacific Oceans. That's about 85% dirt. And it doesn't follow one specific geographical feature, but it goes through a bunch. You know, you cross the Appalachian Mountains, you go through the Ozarks, you go through the Dust Bowl, and then you do cross the Continental Divide, and then you're in the high desert through Nevada and Utah, and then you're up in the Pacific Northwest through Oregon. So,
what trail is that?
I haven't quite solidified that project in my mind yet. Yeah, it's vast. It's tough. Someone who finished both the Divide and this one said that the Great Divide route is like a walk in the park compared to this one. So I'm a little nervous. I mean, I think the hardest part about it is that there are often these big stretches, like 200-mile stretches with absolutely nothing, no water, no food, nothing. So, and not just one or two, but like day after day, it's like that. So I have a lot of work to do to get ready for that kind of mentally and physically. And I need to change a few things on my bike rig, et cetera. But I'm thinking about maybe commissioning 50 composers for doing this, because I think if I can average 100-mile days, I could basically do, it's about 50 days of riding, plus, you know, some days off here or there to, you know, for repairs or backup film data or whatever. But I can basically perform a piece kind of every 100 miles or each day, sort of like as part of the day's work. That's kind of what I'm thinking about right now. So tentatively, I'm calling it Sonic States, which I think is kind of a fun title because there's some double meanings there. So, yeah, lots of stuff happening. Lots of stuff happening. It's just a matter of, you know, keeping myself well rested.
Yes. I, you know, there's the, you know, like ultra marathoners, ultra, you know, cyclists. You're like ultra musician. I love it. Ben, I think you had one more question.
Yeah, well, I mentioned we were going to have, I had three people I wanted to ask about. And the last one we had on the podcast a while ago, and she's one of my favorite musicians, and that is Julie Spencer, who I think you studied with. Is that correct? Yeah. And like just such a warm, beautiful presence in the percussion community, and also someone with, I think, a very unique voice, both in terms of her compositions as well as her sort of, you know, literal voice on the instrument. So could you tell us about studying with Julie Spencer?
Yeah, boy, Julie's great. You know, Julie's the one.
It's kind of like, how much time do we have? I mean, because I'm sure you could go.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, I can be succinct in the sense that Julie's the person who really taught me how to practice music on mallet instruments. I mean, I also learned that I went to Lee Stevens summer camp and I learned a lot from Lee about that. And I learned about from Mike Udo. I mean, I learned from everybody about that. But Julie, at that point in my life, that was the right button that needed to be pushed. And she really, really taught me a lot. And I'm very grateful to her, because every time I get behind a vibraphone or a glockenspiel or whatever, my practicing is far more efficient and productive because of the things I learned from her. Number one. And number two, she got me started on tabla. She was my first tabla teacher. I studied with her for 2 years, yeah, in Michigan. And then when I went to Eastman for grad school, I started working with Bob Becker, and that led me to working with Sharda Sahai, who was Bob's guru, and became my guru. So I really owe Julie a lot, because without Julie, I mean, at that point, I had been listening to Indian classical music every day since I was 11 years old. I mean, really nearly 7 days a week all year long. But I couldn't find a teacher. And when Julie showed up at Michigan, it turned out she had studied tabla with Swapan Chowdhury for a while. And even though she's not known as a tabla drummer, she was, I don't know if she's playing now, but at the time she was a pretty good drummer, and she had really clean and clear technique. And she set my hands properly right from the start. So, yeah. You know, she's the one who, in a formal sense, got me going on my journey with Hindustani music. So I owe a lot to Julie.
Wow.
Very
That's
cool.
Super cool. Yeah. Awesome. Well, Peyton, thank you so much for joining us. This has been just a wonderful hour chatting with you about all of your projects and all these wonderful things. And you're just a delightful person. So thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. I'm really honored to be here. And I really appreciate and respect the work you're doing. You know, keep it up. It's just great. You know, my students know all about the podcast, and it's just awesome. Great contribution to the percussive arts. So thank you for your time and effort.
Very cool. Thank you so much. And Ben and Hannah, thank you for joining us. We'll catch you next week.
Thank you.
All right. Bye, everyone.